Okay.
I don't know about this room.
Yeah, no, I understand, yeah.
Okay. Well, my name is Michael Klein, and I'm with my wife Carrie Klein, and I are interviewers for Talking Across the Lines, a West Virginia-based firm. And we're here in Concord as objective observers, working for the Concord Library. Today is January 15th. It snowed yesterday, but the roads are clear today. It's overcast, but not too cold. Maybe you could start off by saying, my name is, and introduce yourself.
My name is Marion Thornton.
Okay, and we never ask people their ages, but perhaps you tell us your date of birth so we can put it in historical perspective.
September 14th,
1933. 33, okay. And you want to start off and tell us a little bit about your people and where you were raised?
I certainly would be welcome to do that. I was born in Boston, and I lived mostly in Dover, Massachusetts, as a young girl and college girl and early working. I worked in a hospital, the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital, on research, blood research, hematology. And I meant to marry a medical doctor. However, I met a young man sailing on the coast of Maine who was from MIT and married him in 1959 and moved almost immediately to Concord because there was a carpool that went from Conantum, a development in Concord, to MIT every day. So that's how we ended up living in Concord, Massachusetts. Delightful thing to have done. The Conantum area that we lived in was a community of 100 houses with open land around it.
It's called again?
Conantum.
Spelled?
C-O-N-N-A-T-U-M. Conantum. And it was 100 houses that were made by a new kind of planning where you could have 100 acres of conservation land as well as 100 houses done by MIT people. It was a wonderful place to bring up children. We had three, and they could run out the door and do wonderful things. So that's how I started my life in Concord, being a housewife and living happily up in the southwest corner near the rivers.
So 100 houses with 100 acres of open land?
Yes, each house was on 1 acre. It was a new kind at that time. A new kind of development where they did have open land which contained, you know, hills and access to the river, tennis courts and baseball field. And it was a wonderful idea of 2-acre zoning where you owned 1 acre and then the other 100 acres of the 100 houses was open land. And it was beautifully laid out, so it was a safe place for children to grow up, go out the door, and someone would always know it was your kid. So it's a unusual, at that time, very unusual zoning concept, cluster zoning, which probably led me down the path to continue to do things like that.
Can you give us a more detailed description of this open land? What comprised this open land? Was it 100 acres
yes.
in one block?
Yes.
Okay.
It was 100 acres in one block on the Sudbury River, off Sudbury Road. And the houses, as I say, were each put on 1 acre. It was a 2 acre zone, but your house was on 1 acre, and those other 100 acres had a were sort of reading the contours of the line of the hillsides, so that the houses were on flat land and the other land, which was swamps and hills and wetlands and some areas like a playground that were made into a playground and for community gardens. It was done by Carl Koch and Rupert McLaren. Cluster zoning was not really known very well at that time, so it was very innovative. A lot of MIT and Harvard professors came out and lived there. So it was a community we found quite excellent to be in. I really think more work should be done in that area. There are other places, but I think this particular place. Since then, we have moved down the street and built our own house, which was an acorn house in a field across the street from this area, where we put solar energy in, solar panels. I don't know what you're looking forward to.
First of all, on a personal level, we're interested in doing that to our house, so I'd like to hear about these solar panels.
Well, we had them as a heat exchange system, and then some of the solar panels were destroyed by a fire, so we don't have that, but we now do have a new heat exchange system from our well, where the heat is exchanged and heats our house. My husband just recently put it in. So.
You called it an acorn house?
Yes, there was a company called, it was the prefab houses, and they'd come in, you know, with a truck and dump the wood on the ground, and then the house, the panels were prefabricated. It was a company that was in Acton down by the rotary, and then you go right on 2A. I think it's merged with another company now. But it was an intelligent way to build a house because it was less expensive by pre-designing your house. So.
I bet it jumped up too, didn't it?
Yes. Yes. It went up in a hurry. We did have an architect who helped us think it out, and we've been happily living there ever since. And my husband has taught at MIT electrical engineering for 45 years, and now he has his own company, which he goes to very happily every day.
His name is?
Richard Thornton. And his company's name is Magnum Ocean, and he's trying to work on linear motors to run trains and deliver things around faster than anyone, and cheaper and more environmental than any other system. So, but I'm getting, I think, probably going far afield from whatever you wanted to know.
Fits in the Concord picture, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Well, we've loved Concord. Concord has been a very satisfactory place to live for us.
Had you ever been here before 1959?
Yes, my aunt used to come in the summertime, and she enjoyed very much White Pond, which is similar to Walden Pond, a similar pond, but a little bit more west. And she had brought me over here, and my uncle Jimmy Ford lived up in the north part of Concord, in Spencer Brook area. But no, I really had not spent any time in Concord. So.
But you've been an enthusiastic observer of Concord over the past, what, 49 years or so?
Yeah. Well, I not that much because I hadn't been here, but every Christmas to see my Uncle Jimmy and once in a while to see my Aunt Carrie. So I didn't know much about it.
But since you moved here in 59, mm-hmm. what kinds of changes have you seen in the town?
Well, I've seen a lot, but I think a lot have stayed the same as well, I would say. I've seen change for sure. But I think a lot of people have worked very hard to keep it. Well, there's both people and topography. I mean, we have two rivers that form a third, the Assabet and the Concord River, the Assabet and the Sudbury River, which go together to make the Concord River, and a couple of big ponds like Walden Pond and White Pond, but we have a lot of wetlands and everything, so in a natural way, there's a lot of limitation to where people could build. So that has been something to slow down, you know, extra building. I think there's also been a wonderful group of people, volunteers, our committees are volunteer. Even the selectmen, I think they may make $100.
Finger tapping is coming through the microphone.
That's very bad.
That's all right.
Even selectmen, you say?
Well, I think, yes, we have the selectmen. I think maybe they work for $100 a year or something. But we've always had a... I've always found that town meeting has been a very successful instrument to get things done at. It's quite amazing. You can really go to town meeting and think you feel one way, and your friends can, or other people can persuade you that you ought to vote a different way. It's a very wonderful, I like town meeting. It's been for me, successful. I wish more people went, but all the town boards are present and the articles are presented and voted on. And I would say offhand, we usually get what's the best and fairest way to go about things. So I've enjoyed that from the beginning, type of government. And you were asking me something that I've gone off.
Observing change, but no, the meeting, the description of the meeting is crucially important. So talk about it. So it sounds like debate and discussion are still alive and conquered, if nowhere else in the country.
Well, I would say that I think it's recently, sadly, some of it's turned into a place to just say over and over again what you think is right when... I have in the things that I have done and everything, enjoyed the ability to talk with people and maybe come to a compromise. I mean, you know, work things out. I like being with diverse, people who have diverse ideas and trying to make them work together. And I know I was part of a group that worked on something called Haywood Meadow, which is in the middle of Concord, and some people wanted to put a visitor center on it, and some of us wanted to keep it completely open as a testament to the past. And instead of working and slamming ourselves to the walls, we sat down and worked together. Found a good place for the visitor center in the middle of Concord and saved the field by talking things over till we'd come to, everyone felt comfortable with what we were going to do. And I've enjoyed that part of being part of the, not the government, but I was on the Natural Resources Commission, the town of Concord, for about 9 years, I guess.
Natural Resources Commission?
Yeah.
What is its function?
It's, well, you have things like the Selectmen and the Planning Board and the Public Works Department and the Natural Resources Commission, which handles purchase of land or land planning. People who are trying to build too close to a wetland or something. It's a permitting committee. And as the planning board and zoning bylaw, the zoning board, it's one of the town boards. That's one of the town boards I've served on, and I've had also to do with some hazardous, with solid waste management. I started recycling in Concord in 19, I'm not quite sure. I think it was in the 69 or 70, somewhere in there, where we collected paper and bottles and cans at the landfill. And the town manager told me I could do that. And we started a group called Reuse It, which stood for Rescue the Environment and Us from Being Smothered in Trash. And we went out to make people spend a lot of time recycling, and we made some money from selling things to recycling areas. And I think we were one of the first people to, towns to do that.
What kinds of things seem to sell really?
Well, it all depends on the market, but people could see it was a question of what was easy for people to do as well as what money we'd get. We were really trying to clear the waste stream from things that could be reused. So paper was probably our most, that was probably the best. Things that we did was collect paper and cardboard, and we collected glass, and we used to smash it with sledgehammers, but then I had the kids help me from the various schools. We finally were smart enough to put on safety glasses, and we had great fun doing that. I had the schools help me. Fenn School was very helpful, and so was Concord Academy in coming to the landfill and helping me sort out this stuff. I know you're looking at me in an amazed way.
Well, these are all the things that we believe in very deeply, but we don't see much action where we live on this score, so it is amazing.
Well, it was back then. We helped other people form groups in other towns, and we became a regional group. I think we left a mark. And it has since gone on to be a town appointed under the Public Works Department that has handled. They have a day where you can bring your things you don't want and other people do, and then you can, you know, swap. It's a swapping sort of situation where, and there are other things that we did also, but I'm having a blank on some of the other kinds of things, but anything that had to do with recycling we were involved in.
So when you say you collected glass and you collected...
Yeah, we did all that at the landfill. We had permission to do that at the landfill, the permission of the town. And we had people who came and picked up. We had big dumpsters where the glass was put and the cans were put. We tried other things like plastic and milk cartons, but that wasn't too good. We collected leaves, we collected... brush. The town since is collects brush and grinds it up. So the town slowly took on doing things that we'd been doing.
Well, from what you've said so far, it sounds a little bit like coming to Concord in 1959 and living in this new progressively designed community mm-hmm. or neighborhood or mm-hmm. development
mm-hmm.
Made sort of a green activist out of you. Is that right? Or did you always have,
yeah.
or were you raised
no.
with these values? Did you
no.
always have this kind of vision?
No, I certainly didn't. I was just grew up as a kid that was happy to have as much fun as possible and study as much as my parents made me do it. And I went to private school, and I went to Windsor School, and I went to Smith College, and I worked at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital in hematology that I'd been a zoology major. And I knew the next thing to do was to have 3 children and bring them up properly. And when I'd done that for a while, I joined the League of Women Voters and became interested in water. And went out and saw that there were some pollution problems. And I think maybe I made a little splash when I collected a bottle of stuff coming out of a pipe from the Concord Reformatory, which turned out to be sewage, and took it to my representative and said that this had to be changed. And I think that was the beginning of my career. I think the League of Women Voters, I could say, was opening of my eyes that things could be done and I could get them done.
And how so? What was it about the League of Women Voters that gave you this sense of yourself?
I don't know. I didn't even know I was interested in rivers other than paddling on them. I just think that there were a group of very interesting women who were out doing things in various areas. And because I was interested in water, you know, I did a lot of things on the water, sailed and canoed and stuff, and I just became interested in clean water, and then they, in a way, empowered me to go do something about it. They also had to control me a little bit because I had to stay within the rules and regs of working with the League of Women Voters. I mean, you had to always make sure your facts were correct and follow certain patterns. You couldn't. But I did become interested in cleaning up water, which I did spend some time doing.
How did that become defined as an issue?
Well, we had some pollution problems.
The
Concord Reformatory was one. People were using the rivers as their backyard, throwing things they didn't want into the river. So certain things were actually migrant workers were housed or given facilities that went into the river. So like outhouses and stuff. So there were some things to be cleaned up. And so that led to me being put on the Natural Resources Commission in Concord. And I went on to do that, and then I went on to the boards of the Concord Open Land Trust, which Concord Land Conservation Trust, which is a group that buys land for conservation purposes. And I've been on that. I'm still on it, but I was chairman of it for about 9 years. We saved a lot of land. I went on the boards of the Massachusetts Audubon Society and the Trustees of Reservations, and I was on their boards for, I think 20 years for the trustees, and I've been on the Mass Audubon for a while. And so I just found a niche.
Can you tell us more about the land trust and what its goals and purposes were and how,
yes,
how it was funded and so on?
Yes, it was. It's a private group.
What are you talking about?
The Concord Land Conservation Trust was started, I believe, in the 1960s, early 1960s. And it had a board of directors, and their idea was to protect land in Concord that was significantly good open land. And their way of doing this was to have a membership, and then they would raise money either from the membership or they would go outside to conservation groups and get grants from other places. And that's still, we're about to have our 50th reunion. And we're still going strong. We had a lot to do with getting Harvard University to restrict its land in perpetuity in the Estabrook Woods, which is a place that's a big piece of open land between Lowell Road and Monument Street that in the beginning there were people who said that Harvard University ought to have some place where they could do research, their students could do natural research and studies through the Museum of Comparative Zoology, MCZ. So they had a field station in Bedford, in the old Nike base, and then they had this piece of land that was about 800 acres or so in between the Lowell Road and Monument Street, where the MCZ students could come out and do research. But it was never something that had a permanent restriction on it. It had a restriction starting in the 60s that went for 30 years and then ran out. So at that time, I came along with my interests and with some people from Harvard through the Museum of Comparative Zoology, I being the chairman of the Concord Land Trust, and someone from the field station, Museum of Comparative Zoology's field station, and I worked together to make, to encourage Harvard University to put the land in restriction and for perpetuity. In other words, we didn't want Harvard to just say, okay, you can have it for 30 years, but now we'd like to use it for housing or something. So we worked very hard on that project, and I guess that's one of the biggest things that I was really involved in.
Were there big hurdles to cross, or did you?
Well, Harvard University never
start
likes
again,
to.
Please.
Harvard University never likes. We had to persuade Harvard to do something in perpetuity. I think they were not quite ready for that, but they said that the land that they owned, if the land around it were to stay open, then the land would remain good for doing research in. So we went to the people who surrounded this piece of land that Harvard owned, and we encouraged them to put their land in conservation, therefore making about, both in Carlisle and Concord, making about 1,000 acres of land open with trails, open to the public to enjoy. But we were able to convince Harvard to put a permanent restriction, a letter of permanent, putting it in a permanent restricted form, so it will stay open forever. And that was a very big and fun deal to do. We did it with Carlisle and with Concord, with many people involved, for sure. And we think we've done it so it will last.
And Harvard had this desire to have open land surrounding its land, so you were able to leverage that into further acquisitions.
Yes, yes. That was fun to do. We had a good project, and we had a lot of good people working on it. And we had a lot of help from outside groups, like the trustees of reservations as well. They held a lot of the restrictions in perpetuity. So they were a big...
Say that again after she finishes. This microphone picks up everything. They held a lot of...
The trustees of reservations held a lot of the restrictions around the Harvard land. We save land around the Harvard land, and those people put their land in permanent restrictions, which had to be held by somebody, and they were held by the trustees of reservations because they were a big organization in the state. I mean, they were, instead of the land trust doing it, I think we could have done it too, but that seemed to be a good system. The Concord Land Conservation Trust. I was working through the Concord Land Conservation Trust. At that time, I was chairman. But we did other pieces of land, too, in Concord. And a lot of the land has been donated to us, or we've actually helped people to restrict their land by us paying to have the land restricted permanently, the legal processes we've been able to take on. We have a piece right now that we're saving on Sudbury Road. We've had actually to raise $3.5 million to save that piece of land, but we go to our people and we go to the neighbors of the land. And we do a lot of talking and convincing. I think we're going to save this piece. We saved a piece of land recently called the Madison Field, which was to be about 27 houses. And we were able to save that by working with the town. The town appropriated a certain amount of money, and we said that we would contribute $1 million to it. And that went through town meeting and was approved unanimously. They funded it, $1.5 million. I think we donated $1.3 million from private sector. And we're able to keep that field open, which is a wonderful breathing space for the houses in some areas and then the open land that they can go out and walk on and stuff like that.
Can you talk more about that breathing space?
Well, how do I want to say it? We have the natural areas with the wetlands and the rivers. We have a lot of land in Concord that is farmland and used to be farmland. And that space, if preserved, makes it a very popular town to live in, which of course raises the price of houses. But it is a space that people use. It's not just a space that is kept open and people should stay off it. It's all land that people can walk on, or recently everyone loves to walk their dog on some place like this. But there are miles and miles of trails that we have saved one way or another. I can show you a map sometime, but it's just, it allows the critters to live on land. It preserves the birds and the animals. It preserves the well-being, I think, of people to be able to have, if they live on an acre or two, they have the ability to go down the street and get onto a piece of land that it's okay to walk on. And you can always learn something from, we use these lands to teach people as well, the importance of saving land.
What was happening in Concord in the early 60s that caused this rising interest in conservation and in open spaces and so on? Well, weren't there always kind of open spaces in Concord? What was happening?
Well, there are open spaces, but a lot of them were being built up. And so as a balance to the building boom, I would say, probably, that you save some open space in balance to the popularity that Concord was becoming a great place to live, a community, a bedroom community. And you see some communities fill up with houses, and then you see some communities put aside some space in between the houses. Certainly Concord's been a popular place to build. There's great pressure to build here, and there's great pressure to build big houses. We have some that have gone in that are pretty amazing. I'm just trying to think how to explain this, but one of the things that has interested me recently is being able to save farmland, because there is a lot of good farmland by the natural geography of the place. The rivers are providing the sort of areas that farmers have found good soil. And now we're getting more used to wanting to eat close to home, and the whole idea is sort of building up that it would be good to grow locally. Then you're removing your carbon footprint or lessening your carbon footprint by not having it flown in from Argentina or Hawaii or whatever. But we also have some wonderful farmers who have farmed this land and kept the land open. But a lot of them are in their 80s. And their children, they're not sure that their children want to continue to farm the land. So the land trust has taken on a new idea of preservation, which would be to specifically think about farmland and how that can be saved, A, to farm, and B, to keep our open space values are preserved, like the Revolutionary days or things like that. So we're going out and talking to some of these farmers about what they'd like to see, what they would like, because each one of these men, mostly, have certain ideas about what they want. They're very individual people. They're not just people in a group, but the land that is open and farming and pasture keeps our open space integrity. And the National Park owns a lot of land, as you may know, all the way out Lexington Road, which gives you that revolutionary, you know, field look. But we've been in the 9-acre corner where we live. There's a lot of open land that's been used traditionally for agriculture that we're working on saving. So that's our latest.
And what do you find is the disposition of these aging farmers?
Marvelous.
They're not a group, but what is generally their disposition about this?
If they are aging, yeah, we don't know.
She said they were 80 years old.
Yeah. Well, each person is going to be different, and we're just starting this project, but they're wonderful people dedicated to the land. Their land is in their body and mind, you know. So I think most of them would like to have the land farmed and saved for farming, not just open space or a field to put a horse in, but a place to grow produce or to have a group of cows. We have one farmer, Steve Verrill. You should spend your time talking to my friend Steve Verrill, because he owns a farm, and he also owns a successful store where we buy down on 9-acre corner that we buy our produce.
What's that called?
Verrill Farm.
Spelled?
V-E-R-R-I-L-L. He's made a very successful, I think, business out of not only farming but also cooking a lot of things in the kitchen, which we all love to go and buy, or bringing in other things like bread and stuff that we. So.
Does the term agritourism resonate at all with the thinking around here?
Agritourism, you'd have to tell me more what you're thinking.
Well, we've heard of areas and seen a few where farms are actually opening to tourists, much as a maple sugar house would open. People come and partake of the yield, whatever it is, and learn more about the farm and the farmers and the farming family. And there's a big segment of the tourist population now interested in making this a real connection with real people on the land. Does this resonate at all with how you're thinking about this?
Well, it resonates in the area in that there are a lot of groups around here. I mean, Massachusetts Audubon Society that saves land, you know, to keep land open, has a sanctuary in Lincoln, and Drumlin Farm, where they are farming, and they use, they farm certain vegetables and things where they have people will come and pick raspberries and things like that, and they have animals that the people come and look at. They also have something, which there are several other components in the neighborhood, of feeding the poor, the food kitchens. They provide food for food kitchens in Boston. There's something in Lincoln called the Food Project where they do that. They also have kids come out from the core city and farm. We have the old manse, which is Hawthorne's house, who on Monument Street.
Say that again, Monument Street.
On Monument Street, a historic building. What they do there is to, they actually grow vegetables that were only grown in the time that the old manse was thriving. And I'm not going to be able to tell you the dates because I'm very bad at dates.
In what century, though, roughly?
Oh, the 1800s. So there you have people growing vegetables that only were grown then. So that's a teaching thing as well as growing vegetables.
Period vegetables, heirloom.
Species. And then there's a group called the Food Project. No. I can't think of it. Gaining Ground. There's another group in Concord that grows vegetables. Gaining Ground.
What's that all about?
Well, they grow vegetables and give them to soup kitchens or have kids come out and work. There's several projects around in this area where people are being brought back to the land and farming it and using it as education and using it as producing food to help people of lesser means.
In Concord?
In Concord and Lincoln. Yeah, in Concord, yeah.
The recipients?
A lot of the food goes into food kitchens in the core city. We do have something called Open Table, and where people can come and get food once a week. And I do think that we use vegetables that are grown here as well as stores give us, you know, like Crosby's or something gives us, you know, day-old bread or things like that. But that's a different project.
We know of communities where the Chamber of Commerce or the local university has developed a tourist map of all the little farmers' markets, food stand, whatever, in the community, so that somebody coming in who's interested in local food, and as you said, there's increasing interest in that all the time.
Yeah.
Somebody coming into the community can go right to these places, and that sort of has that agritourism.
Well, we have started just, I would say this year. You know, they have the Natural Resources Department, the Public Works Department, and they now have an Agricultural Department where farmers, there's a board with local farmers, and they are having agricultural days where the town square in Concord will be closed and the people will come with their agricultural products, whether it's wool from their sheep or something like that. And then that's quite new. And they've done it like twice in 1 year, so I don't think they'll end up doing it every Saturday or something, because the farmers really say, hey, there are lots of markets around, and you know, that takes time. We're busy guys out there just keeping our farms going. So I don't see agritourism per se, according to what I think you're saying, happening, but I do see that we will have more and more trying to encourage our farmers so that they will stay, that land will stay open. I mean, my perspective is looking at it as land to stay open, to keep Concord looking the way it has looked. But I also appreciate getting my food nearby and want to promote that too. Because, well, the reason moving to Concord instead of living in a town like Dover was that it's a variety of people of all different walks of life trying to live here. More and more with our developing our big houses, we're crowding out providing homes for people of lesser means, but I've always liked living in a community that has people of different means. I found it very refreshing. I don't want to live just in a bedroom community of wealthy people going somewhere else to work. So I guess that reflects in the fact that I married an academic person instead. So it's hard to tell how I fell into being interested in conservation, but it's been very satisfying, each project that comes up.
Did your interest in clean water correspond with the national interest in clean water, the Clean Water Act of the mid-1970s when all that?
Yeah. Yes, I very strongly feel through all that I've traveled all over the world and traveled to look particularly at wild places and things. My husband and I love to adventure in these areas, and I like to keep things clean, unpolluted. I like clean air. I think we have a right to it. I think we should work for it. I think, looking back, that President Nixon was a man who was a president who not only put together the Hazardous Waste Act and the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, but he also saw that they were funded, or is, interestingly enough. And that was back in those days when I was just getting going. Not that I supported President Nixon, but I supported that he did enjoy the environment. I mean, making rules and laws that would help to protect the environment.
It's an ill wind that doesn't blow some good, isn't it?
I guess it's just, it is, I keep remarking that this is a thing that people should think about. I mean, we need to put money towards our environment, as is so well reflected in global warming taking place. And I have traveled to the Arctic and to the Antarctic, so I've been able to see a lot of this stuff. I have not seen change, because I've only been in those two places once, but so, where are we now?
Carrie, do you have questions you want to pursue?
I'm interested in how you negotiate this new terrain of very large housing developments and mansions coming in. How do you work with this new situation?
I don't know, because I have the time to do my environmental stuff, but I am, you know, I'm so busy that I know there's things that should be addressed in Concord, and I have a lot of those examples right on my street. Somebody recently bought a 2-acre lot and was able to just went in and cut down every tree on the place of a forest. And there was no law that said anything about you can't cut down every tree on a piece of land that you own, but it certainly was an enormous scar. So I'm in the process of going to the town with some legislation that both Lincoln and Lexington have that says before you cut down every tree on the place, you have to have a hearing. So that's a zoning bylaw that I think we ought to have. I think the town most recently is, its bylaws and everything are getting more to encourage houses and big houses and indiscriminate ability for people to manipulate the land. So that's one thing where I would like to help the town make a law, and I will be working on this, to see that you can't take down every big and little and everything tree until you have had a hearing about it. I think another example on my street is that the builders built a very big house, and when there was water so that they couldn't make the driveway, they just filled until they could make the driveway. And when they put in the septic tank, it was too wet, so they just filled until they could put in the septic tank. And in the process, that house has a good septic tank and a dry driveway, but the water did go somewhere else. It went down the street and made a pond on somebody else's land, and there is no law in the town that prevents you from building in a wet field. There are wetlands state laws, but we need a town wetland law that can be, you know, water will go somewhere, it doesn't disappear. So I've seen that, and I've seen on my street also a person know exactly I cannot build beyond 20 feet to this stream, but then they've built a great cement wall and filled with tree stumps and things and rocks. And I just think we're falling behind on having good zoning bylaws to keep people from building in inappropriate places. I think we haven't addressed the mansionization. I brought something here where some towns have, where you have a community, an area of little houses, modest houses, and someone will come along and tear down a modest house and build a very big house. And that looks pretty bad because you have little houses and then some monster house. And towns are addressing that, but Concord isn't at this time, mansionization. And I think we're going to feel, I think we shouldn't allow this to happen either. And other towns are addressing it. And recently, I don't see Concord addressing the wetlands or the chopping down all the trees or things that at least should have more concern before the developers can manipulate the land.
Yeah. And how do you propose addressing these?
Bylaws that are passed by town meeting that will give more control to the department.
What could it say? You know, is there simple?
It's not simple at all. It's never simple, but
other towns, there are some models for
there
successful
are some
limiting of this
yes.
Mansionization
or
and how do they do that? How is it worded? How are the restrictions stated in those places?
They are brought to town meeting and they're brought to the planning process, and then they're developed, and then they're voted at town meeting. And people have input at hearings before it goes to town meeting and that kind of thing. So there is a place for tightening up some of our zoning bylaws. I think Concord really has done I've worked on couple of the long-range plans, the recent open space plan, and we did talk about
But there are models for this, and the trick for you or for other people is to sell this idea or broaden people's consciousness about this mansionization problem.
Yes.
We were hearing a little while ago that someone felt his hands were tied until the state made some legislative changes.
Yeah, I think the zoning bylaws, and I haven't gone to be on the planning board or somewhere else because I know my expertise isn't in understanding bylaws and stuff, or maybe my interest isn't either, but I'd much rather persuade people to put land into open land, preserve it. So I have not chosen to say yes to doing, being on other boards, but I think my ability to talk people into keeping their land open is much more successful than understanding the zoning bylaws. So there are zoning bylaws that other towns have, and there is a big state zoning board, and all these things go to give you the tools to make the kind of zoning. You know, I think we should tighten up some of our zoning so that we don't allow just these things that I have talked about to, you know, take place. I think developers will, rightly so, they have a business and they will develop, they will manipulate the land to do what they want if they think there's money in it. And you can't fault them for that. It's just, I think we have done some things recently that are, even when we were working with the Estabrook Woods, we had the Middlesex School wanted to develop its back land, and I would have said there are enough of us who really believe that Middlesex School could have put its playing fields in an area where they did not have to chop down the entire, a great chunk of a very important forest, the Estabrook Woods. And we argued and argued with them, but of course the school is a nonprofit group, and it's an educational, they were able to put the fields in, although a lot of us thought they could have done a better job of fitting the fields on the existing campus and not chopping down a whole forest. That was something that bothered a lot of us. But being a school, they had more rights than some. It seemed. Forest really was a special place just because of its size. Of course, the Estabrook Woods has in the middle of it stone walls, so you can tell that one time it wasn't a forest. Someone was either trying to keep somebody in or somebody out or something. So history does have its way of reminding you of land use in the past. But it is a big forest that, I mean, to save, you know, 1,000 acres of land in two towns that is completely open was quite an event. We did succeed in saving 1,000 acres, but Middlesex School was a thorn in our side. Some of us. I'm not saying anything that anyone is not going to know.
Well, you are an eminently pleasant and well-spoken person, as far as we're concerned, on the basis of knowing you for an hour and 12 minutes.
Wow.
are these is this the approach you use in your trying to persuade or convince
mm-hmm.
people, or are you a fist pounder or
No, I like to work with people.
Okay.
And I think that's been my ability, but I also find it interesting. I mean, I just like people. I like open space and I like people. And I guess the one thing that we haven't talked about is moderate income housing, I think, is something that I wish that we could do in some better way than I think we're doing. And I don't have any short list of things to do for making it happen, but I do enjoy, again, I think we could do more zoning, that we could have, allow in the built area to have more different kinds of housing. I mean, I don't say taking a farm field and building a whole lot of buildings on it, but I do think that we could have better zoning bylaws so that people could live in apartments or different, like they always have. There've always been people on big pieces of land that may have lived in a smaller house on the land. I think we could be more creative with how we presented moderate income housing to Concord, but I'm not about to take on the project myself. I don't have the fire in the belly is turned into embers, maybe.
I don't believe that. Well, what are the arguments that you would see?
To what?
To accomplishing that end.
I'd like to see diversity of people being able to be accommodated in the town. I don't think making a lot of big laws about every piece of land that is going for conservation should have some housing on it. I don't like laws as much as I like sort of tinkering around to see if somebody has a house. I mean, I found a couple of places where the people had an extra apartment or something that somebody could live in of moderate means. And I've just tinkered with seeing that those people know these people, and then you can, so that it isn't a big, okay, this is where our moderate people are going to live, and this is where our... rich people are going to live. I like to see the mixture. I think we could make some of our places more dense so that, you know, businesses could have apartments on top of them or something like that. I think we could do some more creative work there. But I'm getting out of my real ability to do these things.
And when you have newcomers come in, especially in numbers, how do you teach them the values of a community?
Well, that's very interesting, because I just recently, in a couple of things that we've done, we've had newcomers to the conservation world saying that they're great conservationists, but I think they're just complaining about whatever they're doing isn't, they don't get it, but they... what am I trying to say? I don't see them putting either money or time into doing what they're doing. They're just complaining that it isn't being done. So, I don't know how to do anything about that. There are some people who think if they just say it over and over again, then it'll become either law or right or something. I don't. Had a couple of run-ins in this situation. I very much like to see the bicycle path come into Concord on the existing bicycle. Existing train track in West Concord, and a lot of people don't want it in their backyard, but they've become environmentalists, saying that it shouldn't be paved or it shouldn't be built, and I think that's recently annoying me, because I think a bicycle path would be a wonderful thing to have for people to be off the street and bicycling, and I guess that's been one of my recent things that I don't seem to be able to quite solve yet. But anyway.
Well, that opens the whole issue, I guess, of transportation.
I love the issue of transportation.
Which is putting a real squeeze on things now, I guess, isn't it? more cars and.
Oh, I know. That's what my husband would like us to do, is to have high-speed light vehicles that run on levitated tracks.
Would you say that again? Your husband would like to.
His company, Magnum Ocean, would like to have, I don't want to say fast trains because they're not, but they're levitated light pods that would move people fast and get them off the highway and have them be taken to their destinations faster and cheaper and more environmental than the trains we have. It's hard to get people out of their cars.
Is there a website where people could go to learn more about that?
I think you can go to magnumotion.com. I have a card in my purse that I can give you. He's got a wonderful idea.
And his name again is?
Dick Thornton, and he actually works nearby. His company is right on the 62, right on the corner of Sudbury and Maynard and everything. And they would like to be people movers. They move things around production lines and everything faster and cheaper than he's building. He's using Department of Defense money to build a elevator for the George H.W. Bush aircraft carrier to be launched in 2020. And the system will move the munitions up and down in an elevator faster and cheaper than any other mechanical system. I'm not an electrical engineer, so I can't tell you a lot of what he does, but anyway. Transportation is a very interesting thing. I wish we could get people off the highway and have better trains or modules that would move people around, but people are really wed to their cars, aren't they? We all are. I mean, I am wed to my car. I don't pretend to be particularly different than anybody else. But.
Well, certainly in West Virginia, we don't have any alternative. We don't have any public transportation.
We do.
Well, we have a little shuttle bus.
No, what? Wait. I don't know. He's just going to make a Old Dominion. Where's Old Dominion?
Virginia.
In West Virginia? Oh, Virginia.
Virginia.
Okay, he's just won a grant to make a people mover in Old Dominion. To redo the people mover that I think they have, but make a better one. And he just won a grant, and he's actually at his company today, and the press are coming in to talk about it.
And there is one at West Virginia University, some model of a
is there?
High-speed pod.
Monorail that serves the university community.
Yeah.
Experimental. But nobody uses. I mean, the students all have their cars. So nobody
has. Yes, I know. Well, look at the high school here. The high school has to be. We have to have a new high school because we need room for the students to park their cars. I mean, where are we here?
What's wrong with the picture?
is that really what's happening?
Well, because the parking lot is not sufficient for the number of cars that come. And park in it, and those cars are students. The growth of students having their own cars is the problem. There are other problems that the high school has to be redone because the building's falling down and stuff. But one of the concerns is that there isn't enough parking for the student body. I don't know. That wasn't something with my children growing up, luckily. But I do have grandchildren who are now needing a car and have one. And anyway.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Your main goal growing up and as you became a woman was to raise children.
Yep. I didn't I hadn't thought it all out. I mean, I really, you know, it was really interesting that I fell into, you know, clean water and that, the environment. I hadn't even really traveled that much before I met Dick and seen the world and been around, but I don't know how I arrived at where I did. To tell you the truth.
How did you negotiate being a mother and the work you wound up doing here?
Because I did most of my my children. I took care of my children till they were pretty much in school, and I began interested in my third child. I found places that they provided babysitting, so I could take my last child and have him taken care of while we all talked about these things. Don't ask me how it did, but then as my time freed up, I just got involved more. And I spent a lot of time going out across the state with the trustees of reservations and Mass Audubon looking at land. And so I've seen a lot of the land that's been preserved or something, or we did preserve by being on the land. So I really learned, not by going to school, but to being out on the land, what I know. You know, what I know I learned in the laboratory of the land that we were visiting. I don't know.
Well, what you know, you couldn't have learned in school because it wasn't being taught in school.
Right, that's right. One of the things we've done with the Concord Land Conservation Trust is we give a lecture series about, you know, things that do with the environment. And we've asked that the three schools, Middlesex, Concord, Carlisle, and Concord Academy, provide us with juniors, about six juniors and seniors that will come and take a course on, extracurricular course on conservation. And they and a teacher from each school join with people from Harvard. And there's a subject presented and they learn about it. And that sort of tweaks them to get out into the environment more. So that's been a little thing that we've been able to do for about, 70s, 80, 90, yeah, 20 years or so. So, in a small way, we've done that. We're just about to do it. It's just about, we do it in January, February, and March with these kids. It's fun to see them be drawn into it. If we make one kid go into saving the environment out of each group, I'd say we'd be pretty good. Well,
if you're looking at a particular field, an old farm, an old common, with the idea of preserving it, does the specific history of that piece of land, does that play any part in the equation of preserving it?
Everything does. I mean, you have to be pragmatic, okay. First, you have to like the piece of land, or does it do something? Does it abut a river or a pond, or is there a wetland, or is there history? Definitely would play a part. I mean, but you get a bunch of things that tell you that this is important to go after. Then you go out to the neighbors, or you look in your purse, you find out what it's worth to whoever owns it or something, and then you make a strategy. I mean, each piece of land that has come along has been different. I could give you so many examples of just, I'm working, it's wonderful. There's a